Welcome to episode 64 of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Hi, I'm Alex Moxon.
And I'm Drew O'Grizzick. How was your week, Alex?
So at AdaptTech, we're growing. We're actually looking for office space.
How large? Are you looking for 20,000 square feet, 150 billion square feet, 1 square foot?
Probably around 800 to 1,000 square feet. So if anyone out there knows of an office looking to sublet or really cool space, we're definitely interested. So please reach out.
And what are some of the requirements of that space?
Definitely a space to have meetups or a shared space where we can host meetups. Lots of ability to be able to whiteboard. So lots of long walls, open concept.
How many people at AdaptTech now?
So we're now officially 12. We hired our first female developer last week. She's an SFU student and really bright. So really looking forward to working with her on projects.
What sort of projects are in the pipeline?
Everything that we build is based on event-sourced metrics and methodologies. So what we do is we focus on the core business problem, solve for that, and we're really technology agnostic. Technology that a company needs to use, we can tend to work with that. It's one of the things that we really focus on with everything at AdaptTech is craftsmanship. So we want to make sure that we're building the best solution using the right tools and really customizing to solve your business solution.
But always in an event-sourced way. So can you still say that that's tech-agnostic?
Tech-agnostic, yes. The methodology, we only build event-sourced systems.
Our lead developer has given his notice, which is, I think, both a good thing and a bad thing. It also comes at a time where we've hired on, I guess, about 5 people in the last couple of weeks. So a lot of change is happening, and we're really moving more toward writing tests, gathering proper requirements, pair programming a lot more, kind of better exposure to everybody about what's going on. And so it's kind of interesting because now a sort of change in lead dev means also kind of out with the old and with the new. The unfortunate part of that is that it kind of feels like we might be passing some blame for the way that we've developed, which really, I don't think we could have gotten away with it without him. So props to him for that. I mean, it's been a really interesting experience. I'm super happy, on the other hand, that we're moving toward better practices, having good testing in place, which gives us confidence to not just refactor, but change and modify the system and add things. And change things in ways that we can be at least relatively confident that it's not going to break everything. It slowed us down for, I think, a couple of weeks we spent on this so far. And I was really impressed with how not horrible some of the horrible parts were. Like, they're pretty horrible in some areas, but considering like a year of kind of cowboy development, it could have been a lot worse. I like the idea to be able to say, you know, you have to have responsibility as an engineer that your code is good. I like to be able to say that, but then on the other hand, you've got to meet those business needs. Moving forward, we're looking at some different things and actually looking at event-sourced systems as well.
Good.
And I think that might be a good way to go. Although I'm not 100% convinced that it's the only way to go or proceed responsibly and have a good system.
Sure. There's always different ways of doing things. One thing that's really good about event-sourced systems is that they're lossless and they're additive only. So you have a source of truth that doesn't change. You can go back and replay things, replay your events, and really customize your solution. So you don't have to worry about the data migration issues you might with other systems. You don't have downtime in that sense. So it's
isn't that kind of like saying, you know, if you have a well-tested system, you don't have to worry about bugs, in that you still have the what you define as events. You still have to define them well. You still have to engineer it well. And that can take, I think, a long time to do properly. And you probably can miss some things as well. So then you wouldn't be able to have those advantages in some cases.
Well, that's one of the reasons why we do event storming, is to make sure that we've got the business involved and we really look at every angle of the solution. We break down the problem, look at it from a number of different ways, and assume that things have been running for a year and what does the happy path look like? And then design events around there. And then from there, we match those to commands, create read models. So it's a very involved, we really involve the business in the decision, mm-hmm. which is what makes our solutions different. And when I say that we're tech agnostic, it's because we focus on solving the problem first and then recommend the technology that would work best with that.
What about meetups? Did you get to any meetups?
I did. I went to Women Who Code. It was a really great event. And one of the things I like about these events is there's cool speakers. They talk about some interesting things. But it's really the networking opportunity and being able to create that community, create the mentorships. And it's always the side conversations that are interesting. You're talking to somebody about an issue that they're having at work, and you're talking about a solution, and something comes from that. So it's really a lot of fun.
Very cool. Yeah, I was planning on going to the Docker meetup that I really wanted to go to. Mm-hmm. And it was just too far because I was on Granville Island.
Right.
And it was raining and I couldn't get an Evo. Mm-hmm. So I decided not to walk. And then I ended up just working a little bit longer. And by the time I did get an Evo, it was finished. So I didn't go. So what about this week? Anything coming up that you're excited about?
Yeah. Actually, on Thursday, I'm really excited about this. We are combining forces with, DDD, CQRS, event storming. We're combining with digital project managers, and mm-hmm. we're speaking at Mobify. So I'm actually going to be talking with Adam and with Robert. We're talking about event source project management. So it'll be a lot of fun.
Very cool. So that's over at Mobify on Georgia. That's the Microsoft Nordstrom building.
Yeah, exactly.
And what time is that?
That is at 6 o'clock.
My must-go-to meetup is also Thursday, but at 6:30 over at Unbounce is the Van Ruby meetup. So I don't know. Thursday looks like it is all about making a tough choice. So I wanted to give a special mention. There is an AI hackathon coming up in June, and we'll put a link to that. Osama is looking for some food and beverage sponsors. If you're interested in reaching out, go ahead on the VanTech Slack. It's at Osama KHN. And that's our meetups around town. And we're here with our special guest, Nikolai Malyarov of Press Reader. Thank you very much for joining us, Nick.
Thanks for having me on.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about Press Reader? What is it? What does it do? Why should I be interested in Press Reader?
As a consumer, Press Reader gives you access, unprecedented, I must say, access to a whole lot of quality publications from all around the world. Mm-hmm. We currently have close to 6,300 newspapers and magazines. On a variety of subjects, everything from the Globe and Mail to the Vancouver Sun, if you're one of the local newspaper readers, to Elle, to Hockey News, to Cosmopolitan, to GT, everything in the world that kind of fits your fancy is available on Press Reader.
What about in other languages?
If you're a language aficionado, more than 60 languages are available on Press Reader. And in fact, if you don't know some of them, there is a feature on the service that allows you to translate some of the foreign publications into the language that you actually know.
So if I were, say, to go to Hong Kong and I wanted to read a local newspaper, I might be able to do that through Press Reader?
Absolutely. So you'll take a Chinese title and translate it into English, or you take a French title and translate it into English. And
why don't you tell me a little more about how you or how Press Reader came about and why it was interesting for you?
Press Reader was, it didn't start as Press Reader to begin with. A lot of people know us as Press Display or Newspaper Direct, and the company kind of carried those names for almost a decade, probably even longer than a decade, actually. And it was really designed to give access to readers to their hometown newspapers at the time when they're traveling. We started as a company that provided a printed version of a newspaper when you're away. So imagine you're a Vancouverite, you're going to London, you're staying at a hotel, you want to get the Vancouver Sun, which in 1999 and 2000 wasn't really possible. But the hotel would have the service provided by our company that would get you the Vancouver Sun printed on the day of publication. So 5 o'clock in the morning, the Sun is available here. 5 o'clock in the morning Pacific time, the Sun would be available in London.
Very cool.
So that's how it started. And it evolved over the years, obviously. That wasn't, we realized fairly early on that the print product, the print as a medium for disseminating information, was, had an expiry. We haven't reached it yet. I should be absolutely clear about it. There is still a whole lot of people that like the feel of a printed product, and that will continue. It will become niche at some point. But the evolution, the natural evolution of what we started with was to develop a digital service. And in 2003, we pioneered the all-you-can-read access to newspapers. So it's a single service, mm-hmm. one subscription. You get access to everything.
To everything that's available on PressReader?
Exactly.
Wow.
Which at the time was about 150 titles.
Right.
And at that time, you didn't have Netflix. You didn't have Spotify. Blockbusters were still around, actually. And so it was. We didn't just pioneer the all-you-can-read model. We actually pioneered all-you-can-consume model.
That's
but we started
cool.
with newspapers.
And was it called Press Reader at that time?
It was called Press Display.
Press Display.
The word Press Reader actually didn't come about until 2005 in a very technologically geeky, stupid way. But, you know, it stuck around. But Press Display did provide that ability for you to access that breadth of content. And so since then, what we focused on is obviously developing the service. The consumers have changed. The devices that we use have changed. We added magazines to the mix. We grew the catalog. And we started offering now PressReader, not just to individual consumers who are largely averse to paying for content. That's a whole other subject of a conversation. But to give access to PressReader to those who care about content, who care about quality content, and who want to engage with that content.
Something you said a little bit earlier about print media probably always lasting or always being around. Do you think that it would be possible, or maybe you've seen this happen already, to have sort of like a craft printing company, or where, you know, you have the chance or the choice to purchase the online version, but in addition, for an extra $1,000, for example, you can get the leather covered special paper version.
There are a number of publishers that do that, and I think the operative word in your question was the leather version. It's mm-hmm. Print has an incredibly emotional connection, for some readers. They like the feel of the publication. They like to kind of that exclusive nature of it that it provides you to you as an individual. You can sit down with a printed product, whether it's a book or a newspaper or a magazine, and just kind of immerse yourself in it. But what's happening is that that the mainstream of print consumers are, I don't want to say dying, but I mean, you get where I'm going with this. Mm-hmm. And it's really the focus is now shifting to providing that highly personalized mm-hmm. and highly experiential, highly exclusive access to the print product. You see a number of magazines that have emerged even in the past couple of years that are not going for the masses. You know, their print production is under 1,000 copies, but they provide you with that incredibly satisfying feel for when you buy that publication. A, it's relevant to you based on the topic, on the subject that they're covering, but it's also relevant to you because you appreciate the product that they give you. Mm-hmm. So it will have a lasting lasting product, but it is becoming more niche.
That's definitely something I could see happening, and I think until you just said it, I hadn't really thought that it would be something that would last. You know, we kind of tend to think that as we get into, or as we came into the digital age, that everything would go digital. So why stick with news or with press and Press Reader, and how did that come about, and how is it going, and where is it going?
Hmm. One of the things that we strongly believe as a company is to give voice to quality journalism, to true journalism. We fundamentally believe in the role that quality journalism plays in a democratic society. And we're proud of it. I think, you know, just looking at the events over the past few weeks, this whole notion of the importance of press and the press holding the higher-ups accountable is becoming more and more apparent as things are developing. And so what we're focusing on PressReader is to create a platform that helps that quality journalism to survive whatever the, and I appreciate how overplayed this word is, but how disrupted the industry is. I always say that the industry is challenging and it's challenged. It's challenging because it's difficult to operate in within the realities of today. Where the consumers are going, how the consumers are interacting with that content, and how highly personal, how highly relevant that content needs to be to me as an individual for me to immerse into it, and how consumers are surrounded by a sea of content, and to rise to the top of that sea for you as a publisher with your piece is incredibly difficult. So that's the challenging part of the industry. The challenged element is the external factors. And the external factors are the business models, the rise of those who exploit this the situation that has been created, this ecosystem that you can populate it with crap.
So we've seen kind of recently, I think Facebook is responding a little bit mm-hmm. to some of the junk media that's out there. And now having sort of trusted media sources, is this something, I guess it must be something that's going to help to, establish a sort of trusted network of media?
Yes and no. It's a very, very difficult question, primarily because, yes, on the one hand, Facebook garners a lot of attention in the sense that there are so many people. There are over a billion users daily on Facebook and 1.75 or something billion kind of unique monthlies. So on the one hand, you'd think that by them focusing on kind of bringing up that true journalism to the top, that, you know, the such a large audience will be exposed to that. But that's not quite as simple as that. The problem that we're facing as the society is that we are lacking time as individuals to process information. So we tend to rely on sound bites that we're faced with, and we also tend to rely on our trusted circle to pre-vet certain information on our behalf. So the trust, the notion of trust has shifted to people like ourselves. So if I have a fraction of a second to try to understand, is this piece of content real or not? Why would I think that a friend of mine has more time to do that? But the trust that I have in my friend almost predisposes me to believe everything that my friend does. So it's we'll have to see how it develops with Facebook. What we're trying to do, I mean, in working with what some would consider mainstream media, we're sort of trying to rebuild the trust that has existed in mainstream media. There again, it's not black and white. There are a number of issues that you have to look at. You know, the editorial biases, the corporate biases that may play into it. But there was a trust relationship, a trusted relationship between the readers and the media that they were consuming. And so we're trying to rebuild it and transform it to the way that we're interacting with content today.
So I guess a big part of that comes down to the media company and their responsibility to maybe market themselves or present themselves as a trusted source. But on the other hand, how do you vet that? How do you say if they say they're a trusted source, they say they're the true source, what's the difference between, and I guess even with Facebook having these relationships, what's the difference between that and what we saw when, you know, only that sanctioned by the king was licensed to be printed?
I'm glad you brought it up because there's whole element of censorship or individual biases that come into the conversation with this. I think there is a fundamental difference between having something that is, you know, factually truthful and looking at the various opinions based on it, the bias-based opinions based on it, and the piece of content that is factually wrong. So I think with technological advances, and I have read an article yesterday where the author was suggesting that perhaps AI, that when it comes into the content creation or just in general processing the massive amount of content that we're faced with, might help in being able to detect whether something is factually correct and factually incorrect.
That sounds really like a difficult problem, because I've often wondered this. How do we ever know? You know, if you've seen something and I've seen something, the more eyes we have on something, the more perspectives we have on the same thing. So what does factually correct end up meaning?
Well, you know, I have a legal background. So, and generally speaking, when the judge is looking at a specific case, there are certain elements of the case that the judge will evaluate as a statement of fact. Something did happen or something did not happen. And then you go into the precedents and in the case law that will help you to interpret some of that. So I think that's good reference to the content that's being produced by journalists, is something is a fact or something is not a fact. There's no sort of, yes, I'll take a point that there may be, well, it's not quite like this, but it is mostly factual. And I think that's where it's becoming a bit more difficult. I'll give you another example. Last night, there was caught a little bit of, I think it's called the CNN Tonight with Don Lemon. And the last piece that they had on was on the cost of keeping the president of the U.S. and the president's family safe. You know, what is the cost of transporting them to Florida and the Secret Service that goes now with the adult kids on the business trips that these adult kids that are now running the organization are taking. And it was a very, you know, from my perspective, it was a very, very factual piece of, you know, journalistic reporting that this is how many people travel, this is what the cost is, and this is what Trump said back, I think, in 2012, don't quote me on it, but criticizing Obama for taking too many trips. Whereas now Trump himself goes to Florida, Melania lives in New York, and so on and so forth. The panel then was asked to, you know, to pipe in and sort of comment on it, and even the what would be considered Republican pundits were saying, yes, you know, and generally the costs are a bit out of control, and, you know, the Republican idea of fiscal conservatism doesn't really, you know, allow for that, you know, unlimited spend when it comes to this. But everybody understands that you have to keep the president and the first family safe. Nobody's disputing that. And one of the panelists then comes in and says, this is fake news. And so then Don Lemon comes in and says, I'm sorry, let me give you a definition of what a fake news is. A piece of fake news is something that you are deliberately, is something that you are projecting and you're deliberately trying to deceive a member of the general public. That's fake news. What we have reported on are very factually based numbers. This is what the cost is. This is how many people travel. This is where they're going. Full stop. Then you can add your opinion to this. Is this a good way to spend money? Or if not, then what would you do different? So let's not call it fake news. Then the pundit comes back on and says, it's still fake news. And that's when the segment was effectively cut. He's like, you're no longer on my program. Mm-hmm. So I think this is the, you know, there is something that's factual and something that's not. Opinions are great. We live in a pluralistic society. That's what the whole idea of journalism is, that it creates the debate, creates the dialogue, creates the conversation. And we need to foster that. But we need to foster it based on the information that is factually correct.
And I guess the more that you add to that information, the more difficult it is to determine whether it's factual or not. So as an example, sure. If I say I saw 10 people, that would be verifiable by other people who may have seen 10 people, or perhaps I took a picture. And you can count for yourself, there are 10 people. Not very hard to prove. However, I saw 10 people, they were together. Is a completely different story and exponentially more difficult to prove.
That's where having multiple sources covering the same event is absolutely critical. And in an authoritarian society, you don't have that. You have the same party line that's being projected at you, right? The Economist actually capitalized on this very subject when they're doing this context advertising campaign, marketing campaign for the brand, where they would show one picture that was kind of zeroing in on a little, you know, element of the bigger picture, and then the second picture was giving you the complete overview of what was going on. And so it is all about the context. And I think that's where, as I said, the craft of journalism has a lot of place in our society, because they can give you a much broader overview.
What sort of responsibility does or should a platform such as PressReader have for the content available through it?
Our responsibility is to provide as much true content as is available, and let the readers create a platform for the readers to engage with that content, for the journalists to engage with the readers, something that the publishing industry wasn't really doing. You know, it was very much a one-way conversation between the publisher and the readers, and not the other way around. But you have to engage with your audience. I mentioned to you earlier that one of the things that we focused on over the years as a company, we expanded the catalog. It wasn't just because we wanted to provide more value for money for the subscription that we offered. Yes, that's certainly there. But if we take the our vision, our culture is at the center, and that forces us. It doesn't force us. It creates a model for us that this is only going to be successful, and we will only play a part in making sure that we transform the industry into the 21st century if we provide as much content as possible within the same source. The readers are changing. One of the things that we have seen over the years is how the readers are no longer relying on a single source of information, which is great, but this is why I say the paywalls that are created by publishers are a fad. They won't work. So we want to create a platform that readers can access to all that information, all within the same service.
Very interesting. Have you been following the news about Shopify and Breitbart?
Yes. It's an interesting position that they've taken. For those listeners of this podcast that don't know, obviously Shopify has continued their relationship with Breitbart, and they have evoked the notion that they want to give access to all of the information to people. You know, they're not the censor of that information.
Freedom of speech. Freedom of speech, exactly. Against censorship.
We actually have taken the same approach. Now, interestingly enough, we've done this fascinating event with a great panel in Washington, D.C. Just about 3 weeks ago, where the Washington Post, the ABC News, CNN, Cato Institute, which is sort of a more right-leaning think tank and a pollster on the panel, which I moderated. And when we're seeking out, you know, the panelists for this event, somebody has accused us of being very liberal. Now, we don't actually exercise any editorial control over the content that we bring. As I said, our goal is to bring as much content as possible for the readers to engage with it. That's the end of it. But those who were zeroing in on some of the pieces, on some of the sources that we have, saw that we have the Washington Post, the LA Times, the Guardian, and they said, "You're liberal. I don't want to be on this panel." Completely missing that we also carry the Washington Times, which is a polar opposite to the Washington Post. We also carry the National Post, which you could argue is opposite of the other.
It might be worth noting that nobody's arguing that Google should drop Breitbart in their mm-hmm. search rankings.
That's true. That's true. The whole element with Shopify and Breitbart and Ivanka Trump's brand and her products at at various department stores, I think this is where we're so focused on things that are largely irrelevant for us to grow as a society, and things get twisted. This society, particularly the American society, is so polarized today that you tend to take extreme positions, even though you may not necessarily be the person who is extremist in their views. That's not where the focus should be. Now, there was a theory that it could have been a distraction tactic from some of the things that were happening behind the scenes. So yes, let's talk about Ivanka Trump and Nordstrom for 3 days whilst we're holding up people at the border for violating the executive order that has come in out of the blue. So, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it's a great, great comparison with Google and Breitbart.
So when we look at, this is a question I've been thinking of today as we've been speaking. We look at email as an example, and I think in the early days of email, we were writing letters, and we were used to writing long letters, and emails were huge. And they've gradually become smaller and smaller. Some people say email's dying or email's dead. We're using other things, whether it's text messages or, you know, quick messaging, instant messaging, mm-hmm. Slack. Do we see the same type of thing or the same type of trend with printed media, whether that be digital print or digital or print? And I guess we've always seen, you can always skim the headlines. So that's something that's existed.
That's something that existed, but at the end of the day, we, as individuals, we had a lot more time on our hands before. There was a study that was done a few years ago that compared the attention span of a human, where it was in 2000, where it is today. And it dropped by 50%. It was about 12 seconds, and it's like 8.25 seconds, which is shorter than the attention span of a goldfish. Kind of a sobering...
Which you can imagine. I mean, goldfish don't have very extraordinary or interesting lives, I would assume.
That's true, but, you know, but the point is that we, because we are bombarded with so much information that our brains now have to process, we do tend to snack on things. I mean, there's a whole theory of how to use that snacking approach that the publishers have used when they started creating apps and services that would provide you with little news bits. Look at newsletters, for instance. What is a newsletter today? A highly popular thing, you know, and growing in popularity and actually highly monetizable. This newsletter will give you 5 or 6 stories that you can quickly skim in the morning or mid-afternoon and feel satisfied that if you are being asked a question at dinner, you're not going to look stupid, right? It is a problem because in my books, it dumbs down the society. The Globe and Mail was actually an interesting study for me personally, is when they changed their print product. This is probably 3 or 4 years ago now, and they, you know, became slightly glossier publication, you know, started producing additional sections. They didn't just focus on the quality of print or the advertising opportunities that it would provide to new set of advertisers that would prefer that sort of medium. But what they wanted to also change is the editorial practice. And so the daily product has become a lot more snacky, whereas the Saturday edition has become more long form. Now, every study you're going to look at today will tell you that people want long form journalism. People want a deep dive on a specific subject. What is happening, though, is that you tend to spend your weekend doing that, you know, kind of diving deeper into the long form. And you also tend to specialize in what content you're interested in. And this is the other element that we need to be very much aware of. We become so focused on something that is incredibly and highly personal, highly relevant to me as an individual, as opposed to being a generalist. News media, by and large, and I'm talking probably more newspapers than magazines, there is a distinction between the editorial practices of both, used to be more generalists in nature. Can't be with long-form journalism. Nobody has time. It does create echo chambers, which is a whole other element that we haven't talked about today. And, you know, in light of what's happening with fake versus real, true versus not true, it's incredibly important. And it does create us as individuals that are becoming a lot more specialized in specific topics. So it creates an opportunity for niche publications to rise to the top. You're not looking for masses. You're not looking for hundreds of thousands of copies being distributed. You're looking at 500 to 1,000 people. People will pay and will want to access that content that's relevant to them.
Very cool. Well, we're getting pretty close to running out of time. I think we could go on forever. We'll have to get you back on again and kind of dive into some of those other topics. But if people want to reach out to you or find you on maybe social media, what's a good way to get a hold of you?
A number of ways. I'm on Twitter. Could be more active on Twitter, I think. At Malyarov, M-A-L-Y-A-R-O-V is my handle there. I'm on LinkedIn, of course. The best way is to go to pressreader.com. The one thing that we do at Pressreader is I'm the editor-in-chief of the Insider magazine. So we're not just a distribution platform for content. We're not just a social platform for users to engage with that content. We're also a publisher in our own right. So the Insider is a quarterly publication which brings together experts from a number of industries, not just publishing, but music. I mean, we're sitting in the Terry McBride studio. We just interviewed Terry McBride for our latest edition of The Insider that was published in January.
Awesome.
So it's we bring people from all these industries that are all transforming. So fascinating read, and it's worth. We would love to hear. I would personally love to hear from your listeners and on what they have to say about, you know, where is the media going? Where does journalism go? And does the journalism still play a role, an important role for individuals?
Very cool. Well, Nikolai Malyarov of PressReader, thank you very much for being on the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Vancouver Tech Podcast.
Check out our website, vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Rate and subscribe on iTunes. Much appreciated.
You can follow us on Twitter, VanTechPodcast.
Feel free to leave some comments below.
You can also hit us up on the YVR Dev, the Vancouver Tech, the Van Tech Slacks. I'm at James.
And I'm at Drew. Special thanks to Same Room for hooking us up with an integration that allows us to have a cross-team Slack channel, VanDevs.
Do you have a meetup that you want us to plug? Email us, show@vancouvertechpodcast.ca.
Music by A Shell in the Pit from the game Parkitect. See you at one of the meetups around town.